are going to examine how elements of today's media is fueled by prejudice, racism, and sexism, according to our guest this hour, NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans, who is in Wisconsin today and will be giving a talk this afternoon at 3 at the UW River Falls campus called Media, Race, and Stereotypes. More on that in a moment. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Do you see or hear examples of racism, sexism, or prejudice in today's media? How do you think that's affecting our society? What, if anything, can or should be done about it? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk at WPR.org. And we also welcome your questions and your views for our guest, Eric Deggans, who is the TV critic for NPR, also author of Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. His website is ericdeggans.com. That's Eric, E-R-I-C, last name D-E-G-G-A-N-S. And we have provided a link on our Facebook page as well. He will be giving his talk on media, race, and stereotypes at 3 o'clock this afternoon at the Kinnickinnick Theater on the UW River Falls campus. The event is free and open to the public. Eric, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us, give us a little tease, a little promo. What is your message at UW River Falls today?
Well, the message is, as you said, is largely taken from my book, Race Baiter. And I talk a lot about how modern media focuses on niches of audiences. It used to be, not too long ago, say 10 or 15 years ago, media outlets made money by getting together really huge groups of viewers and then selling advertisers access to them. They would put on the MASH finale, get 109 million viewers, and they'd say to Procter & Gamble or McDonald's, if you want to sell these people something, you have to come to us. But that's not possible in today's media environment. It's just too fragmented. So what media outlets do now is they focus on smaller niches of viewers, smaller niches of readers, smaller niches of consumers. And some media outlets use prejudice, racism, stereotypes, some awful messages that are sometimes very disguised and very coded to draw people to their outlet and to keep them from going to other outlets. Mm-hmm. And so what I'll talk about today is how that works. And in a way, you'll get a little bit of a primer on how modern media works, and you'll get a primer on how race works in America today.
Well, what media outlet or which media outlets are doing that in our fragmented media landscape?
Well, I think in an odd way, every media outlet touches on this in some fashion. I talk a little bit, for example, about how CBS's reality show Big Brother features, this is a show that gets a bunch of people together in a studio space that's outfitted to look like a house. And the idea is these people vote one another out until someone wins $500,000. Now, the action is shown on online 24/7, but CBS takes that action that they film and they boil it down into shows that air in prime time 3 days a week. And what we found in over history is that when the white contestants on the show express racist sentiments about people of color in the house, often those comments are not included in the primetime broadcast or they're downplayed. And the only way they're made public is that there are people who religiously watch these streams 24/7, and they see things that are happening, and then they note that they're not landing in the primetime broadcast. And what I'll talk about in tonight's speech is why CBS does that. They're protecting a franchise, they're building reality stars, and they ignore some of the inconvenient realities about some of the ideas that these people express when they're in the house and they're forced to kind of live in close quarters. So that's one example. And then you can look at Fox News, for example, and how they cover race, how they talk about issues like the Trayvon Martin killing in Florida, how they deal with the subject of institutional prejudice or racism. You know, that's a big question in society. You know, do people of color have difficulties in employment and housing and education in part because there are systemic problems, Or is this something that's more the result of people not working hard enough or their own personal failings? I think that's a big question in society that we're actually not addressing directly. We talk about it in proxies. And so Fox News, I think, engages this fight in very coded and subtle ways, and not so subtle ways. So you look at how they cover race issues, and that's another example. And so I have lots of these examples. The book talks about talk radio. It talks about reality shows. It talks about scripted television. It talks about news coverage. This subject touches every corner of media in different ways.
Well, we'll get into more of those examples as we go along. But let's talk a little bit about you and your book. And for those not familiar, you got Bill O'Reilly's attention on Fox News back in 2008, and he didn't exactly have the most complimentary things to say. Let's take a listen to this clip from the O'Reilly Factor.
One of the biggest race baiters in the country writes for the St. Petersburg Times newspaper. Eric Dagans also serves as the chairman of the Black Journalist Media Monitoring Committee. Dagans takes delight in branding people racist. Senator Joseph McCarthy would love this guy.
Oh, my goodness. So he called you a race baiter. Why did he call you that?
Good question. I'm not sure. The book opens with me traveling to a press conference that he held before he gave a speech somewhere near where I live, and I tried to ask him that, and he said he didn't remember it, which I didn't believe for a second. But I think what happened was that he did that commentary not too long after he had this controversy where he talked about going to Sylvia's restaurant in Harlem with Al Sharpton.
Oh, yeah.
And at that time, those guys were friends, believe it or not. He talked about it on a radio show that he had at the time, and he remarked that he was surprised that the black people in that restaurant, which is known for sort of being a home for middle-class and upper-middle-class black people, it's always been known as kind of an upscale restaurant for black people in Harlem. He was surprised that how average the black people were, and he was surprised that no one was, you know, grabbing themselves and saying, according to him, MF-er, I want more iced tea.
Oh my gosh.
And I don't, you know, that spurred a lot of commentary in media. Lots of people did stories. I did a column where I noted, you know, it was great that he was talking about race on his show, but it was kind of insulting the way he talked about Sylvia's and the expectation that he was surprised that black people kind of know how to conduct themselves in public in a way that's not offensive. So perhaps he took offense to that, but he didn't mention that in his commentary. So it's hard to know exactly why he singled me out. But one of the things that I've noticed, and one of the things that made me want to write the book, is that when you're trying to start sort of honest conversations about race issues, about prejudice, about stereotypes, about how they work in society, often people will try to shut you up by calling you a race baiter. They will say that you are the person creating the problem because you're trying to start the discussion and because you're trying to get people to think about these issues in a different way. One of the great strengths of oppression is when it's invisible. And so if you don't talk about how these institutions like media outlets work to advance certain ideas that advantage some people and disadvantage others, then you never dismantle it. And I talk about in the book about studies that show that if you get people to think about these messages that they're being presented with every day that involve, again, stereotypes and prejudice, if you get them to think about them directly, often that dilutes their power and makes them much less effective. It's harder to talk in code when people are constantly examining it. And so that's why I think it's important to have these discussions, and that's why I'm trying to sort of reclaim the word race baiter and almost wear it as a badge of honor. In a way, I'm saying if Bill O'Reilly's calling me a race baiter, I must be doing something good.
Yeah, I'm still trying to figure out why people use race baiter. I've heard O'Reilly or commentators like him, you know, call Jesse Jackson or Al Sharpton race baiters if they're talking about some sort of race-related issue. What exactly does race baiting mean?
I think what they mean when they use that term is that someone is unfairly bringing up a racial controversy in order to gain some sort of advantage. And so one of the big charges against Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson is that these guys in the past have brought up racial controversies, essentially imagined false racial controversies in order to either increase their own power, increase their own celebrity, somehow make some money off of it, and gain some sort of unfair advantage. I will say that you can look in the history of Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton and certainly find instances where they did that. I'm not saying that that doesn't happen. But I also believe that what we're really talking about is a fight about a very elemental idea, which is, have we succeeded in removing prejudice and stereotypes and racism from our institutions and society? Can we look at media? Can we look at the criminal justice system? Can we look at the education system and say that it's truly fair for everybody? And I think the Bill O'Reillys of the world, the Sean Hannitys of the world, the Rush Limbaughs of the world, they believe that the system is essentially fair for everybody, and that if somebody is not earning as much money, if they're in jail, if they're having problems, it's because they didn't meet the standards somehow. They didn't work hard enough. They weren't smart enough. They weren't lucky enough. Something happened in their personal experience that disadvantaged them. There are people like me on the other side of the spectrum who believe that there are still systemic problems in media. There are ideas that get recycled and that get represented to people that encourage people to indulge ideas that are rooted in prejudice and stereotypes. And that makes it tougher for people of color to make their way in American society. And so I think that's really what we're fighting about, but we almost never talk about it like that. And that's why I wrote the book, and that's why I'm giving these speeches. I'm trying to get us to really focus on the real issues that we're arguing about. So when we get into conflict about welfare programs, or we get into conflict about affirmative action programs in higher education, or we get into conflict about criminal justice programs and policing and stop and frisk programs, what we're really fighting about at its core is, does institutional prejudice and racism exist, or does it not? And that's really what we should be talking about sometimes.
We are talking with Eric Deggans. He is TV critic for NPR. He is author of Race Baiter, How Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. He'll be giving a talk on media, race, and stereotypes at 3 this afternoon on the UW River Falls campus. That event is free and open to the public. And he is talking with us this hour, and we welcome your questions for him. We welcome any examples that you might see of racist or sexist stereotypes in media. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Coming up, we're also going to be talking about some current examples in the news. Talk about rocker Ted Nugent and his comments recently about President Obama. And we'll also talk about the so-called loud music trial in Florida and whatever else you want to talk about. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org.
I have obviously failed to galvanize and prod, if not shame, enough Americans to be ever vigilant not to let a Chicago communist-raised, communist-educated, communist-nurtured, subhuman mongrel like the Acorn community organizer gangster Barack Hussein Obama to weasel his way into the top office of authority in the United States of America.
Well, that was Ted Nugent calling President Obama among other things, a subhuman mongrel. We will get our guest to react to that, and we will also welcome your reactions and your questions for our guest. He is the TV critic for NPR and author of Race Baiter, Eric Deggans. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page at The Joy Cardine Show. So, Eric, this isn't the first time that Ted Nugent has said outrageous, eyebrow-raising things. How significant do you think these latest comments are?
Well, first of all, I got to say, I am really, like, sort of embarrassed and bummed out because I used to be a Ted Nugent fan.
Oh.
I'm a musician, too, and, you know, I always loved his early work, so it's kind of sad for me to see him sort of descend into this madness that he has embraced over the last, 10 years or so. What we hear in that speech, just to be a little more academic about it, is a series of hot-button phrases. He said the word communist three times. He evoked ACORN, this much-hated and now obliterated civil rights organization that was that used to work for, to sign up voters and was Democratic leaning and working with the poor. And we heard this subhuman mongrel phrase sort of tossed in the middle there. Now, that subhuman mongrel phrase is a phrase that white supremacists use to refer to people of color and in particular to refer to a practice that they hate, which is race mixing, which is people of different ethnicities, people of color having babies with white people. So I'm not sure if Ted Nugent knew the awful legacy of that phrase that he used. But one of the things that strikes me about a lot of the more aggressively offensive things that he said in recent years is that they feel like they've been taken right from the white supremacist handbook. So you have to wonder if Ted Nugent isn't a white supremacist who just doesn't come out and say it. That subhuman mongrel phrase, again, Wolf Blitzer was on CNN and noting that that phrase was used by the Nazis in World War II to explain and justify why they targeted the Jews for extermination. So this phrase has a long and storied history in prejudice and racism, in stereotypes, and in white supremacy. And so the fact that you would use it to refer to a black president who has been elected not once but twice by the American people and somehow imply that he tricked people or, as he said, weaseled his way into the White House. I mean, there's all sorts of things going on there. They're devaluing his Ted Nugent is devaluing his achievement as a politician. He's reducing him to an empty stereotype. He's evoking these code words that people who follow white supremacist movements know very well. They will recognize that subhuman mongrel phrase in a way that people who don't know those movements wouldn't react to. And that's the danger of these ideas. If you don't expose them and talk about them, people like Ted Nugent can give a speech, and most people accept it on one level, oh, he's just being crazy. But people who follow white supremacist movements know that he has a very specific message for them. And it is coded in these phrases like subhuman mongrel that if you don't know their legacy, you don't necessarily know exactly what he's saying.
Well, what message do you suppose it sends when some conservatives will still welcome Ted Nugent's support on their campaigns?
Well, I think that's exactly the problem is that and many people have pointed this out. The concern is that they're trying to essentially court the racist vote without openly speaking to these people. So they'll have somebody like Ted Nugent, who's a proxy, who will go out and drop these code words and say these outrageous things and enlist the aid of people who don't like Barack Obama because they don't like black people and they don't like the fact that America has a black president. So these political candidates can enlist the support of these people without directly appealing to their racism. And this is something that I'll talk about during the talk. I'll talk about what I call dog whistle politics. You know, if you blow a dog whistle, humans can't hear it, but dogs can. And dog whistle messages in politics have one message for the general public, but they have another very specific message for an audience that it's intended for. And we've seen in history, in political history, that there are often politicians who will use dog whistle messages to reach out to racist people and prejudiced people. And their message is disguised. On the surface, it seems like an innocuous message or a typical political message. But when you know the meanings of the code words that they're using, you understand that they're meant to resonate with a specific audience in a different way. Mm-hmm. I talk about how Newt Gingrich used the word food stamp president to refer to Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. And on the surface, he says it's about the numbers of people who were enrolled in the food stamp program when Barack Obama was president. But beneath that, there's a resonance in this image of a black president handing free money to black people who are on welfare. And this has all been borne out in studies and in academic analyses. This is not just me advancing an opinion. And it's something I talk about in the book.
We have some callers who would like to join in, so let's go to Eric in Endeavor. Hello, Eric. What's on your mind?
Morning. Morning, Eric and Joy. Hey, I think when you step back and look at the bigger picture, I think we're doing pretty good as a society when we're able to pick apart the subtle nuances of the media speech as opposed to, you know, utter all-out racism. And I agree that Bill O'Reilly is a huge jerk and that's how he makes his living, and we're actually promoting him right now by talking about him. But I think that everybody wants their freedoms, but Bill O'Reilly shouldn't have the right to his thoughts and opinions and free speech. That's kind of funny to me.
I don't understand that last part, Eric.
Yeah, okay, I don't think anybody's implying that Bill O'Reilly doesn't have a right to free speech, but as I often point out as a media critic, free speech comes with consequences. The right to free speech in America means you have the right to say controversial opinions without being arrested by the government. But that doesn't mean that you're free from consequence. If you say something that is prejudiced or stereotyped and it turns off a bunch of people and they decide that they don't want to watch your show anymore, and then the people who employ you decide that you shouldn't have a show anymore, that's not about free speech. That's about how the marketplace works. So nobody's saying Bill O'Reilly shouldn't be able to say what he wants, but I am just pointing out elements of his presentation that are not fair, that are rooted in prejudice, and then encourage stereotyping and prejudice, and in fact encourage a system where white culture is dominant. And we have to have these discussions. And that doesn't threaten his free speech, I don't think. One other thing I would point out is that I also talk a bit about the differences in how people of color and white people sometimes perceive racial progress. There was a study done that I talk about in the book. I think there were researchers at Stanford and maybe Yale. I'm not sure I'm quoting the schools right, but they polled a bunch of different people, and they asked them to judge racial progress. And what they found was that most of the white people they talked to tend to compare where we are right now to where we used to be in terms of racial issues. So they look back and they say, we don't live in segregation anymore. People of color have the right to vote. We have all these laws sort of guaranteeing equal employment and equal housing opportunity. We seem to be doing pretty well. People of color look at where we are right now, and they compare that to where we should be. So they look around and they say, we still have people shooting unarmed black kids in the street and getting away with it. We still have unequal earnings. You know, a black man with equal education to a white man earns 75 cents for every dollar he earns. You're more likely to be executed on death row if you're a person of color. You're more likely to get a more significant jail time for drug offenses if you're a person of color. There's all these sort of things that that unfold in society where people of color are penalized more significantly. So a person of color might look at that and say, well, we still have a ways to go. Now, we're both looking at the same situation, but we're using different yardsticks to judge it, And if we understand that, then we can talk to each other about these issues and maybe come to some common ground. And I sense in Eric's question a bit of that. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm looking at where we should be. He's looking at where we used to be.
I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Eric Deggans. He is TV critic for NPR and author of Race Baiter. He's going to be on the UW River Falls campus today, giving a talk on the media, race, and stereotypes. It's at 3 o'clock this afternoon. It's free and open to the public. There's more information on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I wanted to ask you, and just because it's an abbreviation, to talk a little bit about the so-called loud music trial and the media's role in that that took place in the state of Florida.
Sure. Well, we recently had a fellow by the name of Michael Dunn who went on trial for an incident at a gas station where he pulled up next to, he was in a car that was next to a car that was playing really loud music. There were several young black males inside the car. He asked them to turn the music down because he found the music disturbing. They turned it down, and then they turned it back up, and there was an argument that ensued. He reached into his glove compartment and pulled out a weapon and shot into the car several times. He killed one of the boys wounded some others, and he went on trial for that. The verdict came in, and he was convicted on attempted murder charges for shooting at the boys that he missed. But there was a mistrial declared because the jury couldn't agree on the murder charge for the boy that he did kill. And so people didn't understand why he could be convicted of attempted murder for shooting at people that he didn't hit, but he could not be convicted of murder for shooting and killing the one boy he successfully hit. Now, the way we've since had a juror step forward and do an interview with ABC News, and the way the explanation she offered was that the man had alleged that he thought that one of them had a weapon. It turns out they were unarmed, and he also alleged that the boy was getting out of the car and he felt threatened. So they couldn't agree on whether or not it was reasonable that he felt threatened by this boy, and the evidence of whether or not he had even tried to get out of the car was inconclusive. There were three people in the jury who couldn't agree on whether or not it was reasonable. They thought it was reasonable that he felt threatened by this kid. And so he shot and killed the kid, and then the car pulled off, and he kept shooting at the car. And that led the jury to convict him on attempted murder because the car was leaving the scene. It was going away from him. Why did he keep shooting at the car?
So, Eric, what does media have to do with the jurors coming to that mistrial?
Well, again, the idea here in Florida, especially, you know, I'm based in the Tampa Bay mm-hmm. area, and the concern is that we have these legal cases turning on whether or not someone feels threatened by someone else. Mm-hmm. If you have a quote-unquote reasonable fear that your life is in danger, then you can use deadly force against that person whether or not they fully demonstrated that they have the capacity to even kill you. So the concern is that there's such a stereotypical image of young black males and their the possibility that they might be violent, the possibility that they might be uncontrollable, the possibility they might be quote-unquote thugs, that people are overreacting in normal situations. And when they overreact, it is hard for them to be prosecuted because it's hard to convince juries that their fear of black males is unreasonable. And that fear comes in part from media images and the way we talk about black males. And in particular, again, I hate to keep bringing them up, but the way Fox News talks about these issues. One of the big tenets that we hear about in conservative media is this suspicion that crimes committed by people of color against white people, especially black people against white people, are underreported. You see it on websites like WND.com, WorldNewsDaily.com, Breitbart.com. You hear people like Rush Limbaugh talk about it. Bill O'Reilly spent a lot of time talking about a case in Virginia where he felt like that happened a few years ago. And so if people sort of feel like there's an element where white people are under siege by black people, then you have a situation where teenagers are being teenagers and they argue with somebody about turning their music down, and then all of a sudden it becomes a deadly confrontation.
We have other callers, so let me go to Tim in Ladysmith. Hi, Tim, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Very interesting program. I guess, you know, as a white male, you know, I'm appalled by racism, and but just to play the devil's advocate here, one of the things as being a white person that I think sometimes we get kind of tired of hearing is the guilt card constantly. And I think a lot of, you know, what I heard from Martin Luther King Jr. was a race-free America where we don't look at the color of people's skin. But I think your guess is a little bit naive or a little bit biased, unfortunately. And I think a lot of this stuff tends to be not so much always racism as it's the leftist versus right way of looking at the world. I do think the media, you know, I know your guest likes to bring up Fox News, but the rest of the media, which is tends to lean to the left much, uses race constantly because it's sensational and it sells news. And they're always trying to turn something into a race thing. One of the things with this president, for instance, is it's a constant droning by the left that if you disagree with him about anything, it's because he's black. But the fact of the matter is he was elected because of white people's votes. And I know there are racist people that don't like black people and vice versa. But the fact of the matter is, it isn't always because a person's black or they have a racist thing. It's just sometimes it's the way we look at the world. And
Tim, I'm just because we lots to chew on here. Eric, what about Tim's comments that this is more a left versus right thing, not necessarily a racism thing?
Well, what I would say is it's both, because again, what I'm saying is that liberals believe that institutional racism is an issue in society, and conservatives tend to believe that it's not. And so this is a central conflict. And what ends up happening is that we end up arguing about the symptoms of this central disagreement. So he's saying it's not a race thing. It's not a race thing because we all agree in America that racism is awful. So we try to move the conversation to a place that we can more easily handle the conversation. So we say, oh, it's about welfare, or oh, it's about affirmative action, or oh, it's about policing policies, or oh, it's about government spending. But in the end, many of these arguments are about this central question: does institutional racism and prejudice exist in society? And if it does, how do we stop it? How do we get rid of it? Liberals believe it exists. Conservatives tend to believe that it doesn't, or that it doesn't exist to the extent that many liberal people believe it exists. And so what I'm saying is we need to talk about the real problem. People want to avoid talking about race because it's a very uncomfortable subject. I understand that. But it's like any relationship that you have. If you're in a marriage and money is an issue and you never talk about money, it becomes a huge problem in your relationship, and it surfaces in ways that you would never expect. You have arguments about everything else. and when you sit down with a therapist, you realize it's really about money. Well, I think in a weird way in America, we're doing the same thing. We have all these arguments about all these ancillary political issues, and we have a hard time facing what the core of the argument really is. The other thing I would say is that Martin Luther King Jr. did not say that we should live in a race-less society. He said we should live in a society where men are not judged on the color of their skin, but on the content of their character. I'm an African American, and I feel like I have a rich cultural heritage as an African American. So when I engage with the world, I want people to see me as an African American because that's part of who I am. I just don't want to be judged negatively for the fact that I'm an African American. I am a journalist, so I am really engaged and excited by learning new cultures, meeting different people, and understanding and learning their story. So I'm not going to pretend that we're all the same on that level. We all have different heritages. We all have different cultures. They make us who we are. They add to the richness of our life. We have to figure out a way to be excited by that and to enjoy that and not be afraid of it. And that's what I'm sensing in some of these comments. We're afraid to acknowledge our own difference and celebrate that rather than see it as a negative.
We're talking with Eric Deggans. He is a TV critic for NPR. He is the author of Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. And he will be speaking on the UW River Falls campus this afternoon, talking about media, race, and stereotypes. The event is free and open to the public. It will be at 3 o'clock this afternoon at the Kinnickinnick Theater on the UW River Falls campus. If you would like to talk with him about race and stereotypes in the media, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network.
I'm Jimmy Fallon, and I'll be your host for now. Of course, I wouldn't be here tonight if it weren't for the previous Tonight Show hosts, so I want to say thank you to Steve Allen, Jack Parr, Johnny Carson, Jay Leno, Conan O'Brien, and Jay Leno. Very, very nice. Amazing.
Well, that, of course, Jimmy Fallon on his, I think that was his first monologue hosting the Tonight Show, and our guest, Eric Deggans, wrote about part of Fallon's appeal in his blog. We will ask him about that. And again, welcome your thoughts and questions. So, Eric, what you said that that Fallon was living the fantasy life of a millennial white guy?
Yeah, you know, that's what's so interesting about Jimmy Fallon. Like, basically, NBC has been trying to figure out who would be the successor to Jay Leno for 5 years now. And at first they thought it was Conan O'Brien, and now they've advanced Jimmy Fallon. And really what they've been trying to do is figure out who is the new voice that speaks to millennial fans of late night comedy. Because that's the key demographic for advertisers, especially in late night. And they're afraid that Jay Leno, who's in his 60s, is not going to appeal to a 20 and 30 something crowd, which is where they make the most of their money. And Jimmy Fallon has built a show that in many ways it feels like a young millennial white guy's playground. He hangs out with, you know, cool music people, everybody from Bruce Springsteen to The Roots. He's heavily involved in social media. He had a bit on last night where he played charades with, famous people, famous actors and a country star. He is living the life, you know, but he is also appealing to a very specific audience. It's not a coincidence that almost every host in late night is a white male. It's because that's the audience that they're targeting in late night. Just as it's not a coincidence that many of the hosts of daytime TV shows are female, because that's the audience that they're targeting. You have to look at who is the most primary figure on a show, and then you have to look at who is the show's content seeming to target, who is the show's content most appealing to. And if you look at shows like The Daily Show and Colbert Report and Jimmy Kimmel and Jimmy Fallon and Conan O'Brien, you can't escape the fact that 20 and 30-something young white males are the target audiences for all those shows.
We have other callers and emailers. Lynn in Minnesota emails, "I'd like to hear Mr. Deggans' take on CBS's The Amazing Race, which seems to ride roughshod over other lands and cultures in a rush to win the money pot. I wonder what impression this leaves of what Americans are all about.
Yeah, I guess, you know, they have created a show that is basically like your worst vacation realized, where you're constantly under pressure to find places. Getting lost could cost you hundreds of thousands of dollars, and you know, the stakes are very high. You're only in these countries for like 5 minutes. You only get to meet people kind of in passing. You're way more focused on getting to the next destination than you are on exploring wherever you are. Yeah, there's a lot of odd things about The Amazing Race that come out when you watch the show. But I will say that I think that is a show, in fact, that has the fewest problems with embedded negative messages about prejudice and stereotyping. I think shows like Survivor and Big Brother and The Bachelor are much worse, much worse on those scores because of how they try to appeal to their audience and the messaging that's involved in the content they present.
Let's take another caller. Raymond in Merrill is with us. Hi, Raymond.
Hi. Well, you're certainly going to have a good time in River Falls. Going to be a little shift from the weather down in Florida, I can tell you that. So have fun, buddy. I'd love to make it over and see you talk, but I'm not going to drive in this stuff.
Anyway, I'm afraid too many people are going to feel the way you do.
That's what I'm afraid of, too, but good luck. The students there will be there. But anyway, I wanted to talk about, I don't want to forget about a group that's really been marginalized, and that's the Native American. They've kind of seems like they're being whitewashed right out of our history. About the only thing that's media worthy is the Redskins controversy. So I'm worried about that. But just I wanted to drop another question on you. And since I didn't know you were African American until you announced it, what do you think that our president is only engaged in a beer summit to deal with the issues of race? And other than that, really hadn't stepped up to the plate. Other than that, I'll have fun.
Well, thank you for all of that.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate your. I must be insane. A Floridian who came up to Wisconsin in winter. But
first things first, let me let you know that 4 to 6 inches of snow during the day, and that's probably what this afternoon, 4 to 6 inches or so, and then another 3 to 5 inches tonight in the River Falls area.
Yeah. Just so you remind everybody how bad the weather's going to be.
It's going to be fine.
Right after my speech.
Hey, we're hardy in Wisconsin. We get out. This is nothing. This is a dusting.
But two great questions. First, on the Native American issue, I totally agree with you. I do think that Native American issues have not been talked about a lot. There is a great show coming on Sundance Channel called The Red Road. It's a fictional crime drama that's centered in the Native American community, and it's not stereotypical. And I would suggest that people check it out. Although the two leading Native American characters on the show are played by people who are not Native American, I will admit that. But I still think it's a well done show, and it's worth checking out. Secondly, I would say I do talk in the book about how it's ironic that our first black president is in a political position where he can't really talk about race. And when he talks about race, his unfavorable ratings with white voters go up. And even though he was elected with white votes, he received a smaller percentage of the white vote than many previous successful presidents. So he has to be careful about when he talks about race and how he talks about race as president. And I say in the book, and I say in my speeches, I can't wait to read the book that Barack Obama writes when he is out of the White House and he's free from political considerations and he can really speak his mind about what it was like to be our first black president.
Mm-hmm. You know, we didn't really follow up on it after a caller brought it up, saying he didn't like the implication that if you disagreed with the president, you were racist. And
I think there are some fig leaves and canards that people use in political discussions, and I think that's one of them. I think serious critiques of President Obama, I think people who are serious in talking about politics and talking about media like I am, I only charge prejudice when you see somebody like Ted Nugent stand up and call him a subhuman mongrel. That is obviously rooted in race. When you see somebody like Newt Gingrich stand up and use the words food stamp president, there is a double message going on there. Certainly, there's plenty of criticism that you can levy at President Obama that's not rooted in race. But I also think that you have to be willing to look hard at people who seem to be trying to play this game of using code words. And if you don't hold them to account, then that's when these ideas are able to flood the public space. Why are people, why are a certain subset of people so convinced that he wasn't born in this country? Why are they so convinced that he's not Christian? Why are they so convinced that he's a communist? A communist? Mm. Where did that come from? There is a desire to see Barack Obama as some other, and I'm using other as a phrase, as an academic phrase. There is some desire to sort of explain away how he got elected as president and create this fiction where he's not American, where he's not one of us. And that is rooted in prejudice and stereotypes.
Jerry in Milwaukee, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to give your point a chance.
Yes, good morning. I'm really enjoying the show. You know, I'm calling because your dad is a media critic for NPR. And in fact, and this is a very interesting discussion we're having, my criticism is, in fact, NPR. You know, NPR, if you'll note, there are very few, in, let's say Wisconsin, minority, black specifically, hosts on NPR.
You know what, and I'm not cutting you short because you're criticizing Wisconsin Public Radio or National Public Radio for lack of diversity on staff, but we're almost out of time. Comments on that, Eric, and whether that's what's needed to change this?
As you know, the public broadcasting system is complex, and I work for NPR, which is the national group, and it doesn't have any control over Wisconsin Public Radio and how it's staffed. So these are two separate issues. I will say that NPR is aware that it has diversity challenges, and it's trying hard to be more diverse and reflect diversity. We have a blog on diversity called Code Switch. They hired me. This book that I wrote came out long before I got the job offer from NPR, and I think they really wanted the perspective that I bring on racial issues, and they wanted to make sure that not only I provided great coverage of television, I'm the television critic, not the media critic, but they also wanted to make sure that we had a robust discussion about difference and culture and all the cool things that are going on in society on that level as well. So I'm doing both for NPR, and I think we're going to get better on that score as we go forward.
Yeah, and we'll have to leave it there because
we
are
aware
of
it, and we're certainly trying to be better.
Thank you so much for being with us, and I hope you'll talk with us again.
Certainly will.
Eric Deggans is TV critic for NPR, author of Race Baiter, and he'll be talking on the UW River Falls campus this afternoon about media, race, and stereotypes.